Good to see everybody tonight. At home with this kind of weather, it's asking the folks to stay home. They just can't drive in the rain. It's so good to see. I saw everybody. It's so good to see that the sky can still do that. I guess it knows how to do that here. Good to be standing before you tonight. Joe had contacted me, of course, a couple of weeks ago and wanted to know what my sermon topics were, and I told him I just sort of had been thinking about some things about evolution, and I've actually designed two chart-heavy sermons on evolution, and they were Monday and Friday night, and so we put it on the chart that way, and the Friday night sermon is supposed to have been that, but he told me I could change that if I wanted to, so I kind of merged the two today, and we'll have a different sermon on Friday night, just one sermon on evolution tonight. And as I was doing it, I realized that some of the themes were so similar, why not? You know, so it's I hope to offer some things that will make you think, and I would imagine most everyone here is a believer anyway, but believers need to have ammunition. You need to know some things that some of these things are going to be common that you already know, but we're hopefully can develop the ideas and the concepts in such a way that it's easy to understand. And so many of us say simply by our own observation we have determined that the Word of God and the witness of the Word of God in our hearts that we believe is absolutely the truth. We don't have any doubts about those things. But you know, I heard an old preacher when I was a young man that he preached a very interesting lesson. I wish I could preach it exactly the way he did, but the concept I grasped was Brother Robert Turner down in Central Texas, south of us a little bit. And he said that for most of us, faith actually begins at a funny place. It begins out of doubt. And when young people, and this is exactly the way it was with me, when young people come along and they begin, I think you can think of this way, when they begin to think on their own, you know, most of us, as he taught, we have learned our faith in God from our parents. If we grew up here with godly parents and they've always taken us to worship and we were in Bible class and we prayed at home and studied at home some and those kind of things, we will as small children, will say, God is good. Mom and Dad said He is good and He is there. And that's our first type of faith, that we believe, yes, the sun is there and the rain and the flowers and all those things, simple concepts for children, and God is good because He provided those things. And our faith comes from Mom and Dad telling us. And then a little later on, we may become, as we grow, we may say, well, this is what we've always done. So we have sort of an orthodox faith that we accept things without asking many questions, although we know a whole lot more in our own faith. But at some point, most of us, maybe in teenage years, it was that way for me, begin to think about, well, why are things the way they are? And just because Mom and Dad said there was a God and that He's good, is there really a God? And if parents are scared when they hear their children say things like that, they, you know, oh no, what have we done wrong? But the thing is, your child has developed their own brain. That's a good sign. It's a good thing that they can begin to think for themselves. Now, the part that parents and others play in that child's development in their faith is providing them with the right information to guide them in that search. But I really do believe that it's something that we as individuals have to determine for ourselves and come to an acceptance of truth. And we may throw all kinds of things against it to see if it will still stand. But in the final analysis, at the final call, we will have made up our mind. Now, what I want to do tonight is I want us to show some very simple things most all of us find as remarkable. So I can get my, there we go. All of it's not on there, but that's okay. The main part is. This skeleton that you see over here, it was a very skillful photograph that was taken. I think this was on Smithsonian. I got two of my slides from Smithsonian. And that is Mikhail Baryshnikov when he was a famous ballet dancer. And somehow they froze framed something and were able to superimpose his skeleton into the actual image of his body as he was in a whirl, you know, up in the air dancing. And, you know, the actual beauty of you can see the muscles in his legs and his arms, and you can see even the muscles in his neck behind the skull. And you see the beauty and the grace that is possible in the human form. That's why some people love dancing, because they see that in it. But, you know, the child of God understands that the vanity that comes from that and the danger that comes from that, of course, would be wrong. But we can still appreciate the suppleness of the human body and the strength of the human body, especially at that young and strong age of being able to do such things. And I named this sermon originally, this idea of the wonderful, complex man that God created. And to think of this in the sense that everything that we ever think about in wonder about humanity, because there are many great, wonderful things to think about how we have been created, the beauty that is actually in mankind, a wonderful thing for us to contemplate. And Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 through 31 is the account of the creation of man. And the idea that is expressed there by the Lord, let us make man in our image after our likeness, verse 26. Now, in what I wanted to talk about in this first couple of slides, sometimes we're not really aware of the wonders of the human body. Just some simple observations that you think about what makes a human. What is it that is unique about us? And it turns out there are many. In fact, I made a list here, and after I made the list, somebody said, well, what about this one? And, you know, and I'll mention that too at the end. But I've got a whole list of things that make us sort of unique as a creature. Now, all kinds of creatures have, there are like eagles that have incredibly good eyesight, better than ours. But we have binocular color vision. And, well, there are several of the great apes that also have that. The eyes are set in the front of the skull and give some binocular vision, and they're able to detect color so that they can pick out ripe fruit and food that's worthy of eating. Either too ripe or green and not ready to eat, but just the right color that you know that it's ready to eat. So we share that with some other animals, a few other animals that have these unique things. But also, unique among all mammals is the fact that we walk bipedally, just 2 feet, 2 legs, upright. There's no other animal in existence that walks that way. Now, it could be, from some of the fossils that have been dug up, that there were extinct apes that walked on 2 legs. They're all extinct now, but they have found the fossils of some that seem to be upright apes. So, you know, there's not really any way for certain that even anatomists can say that they walked on just 2 feet like we did, or 2 legs like we did, and maintain their balance. But we do. We do have this ability. And we actually, you know, one of the things that a podiatrist or someone like that might do is say that, you know, if you lose your big toe, you're going to have a hard time walking. It's just not really possible. Think about how when you run or how you balance yourself, that the big toe is critical in balance. And also when you walk, when you roll a foot forward, it actually propels you forward. So when you lose that ability, or it's amputated or lost in an accident of some kind, it has a major crippling effect on the individual. We've known a lot of people, of course, that have problems with that. But it makes us unique in the ability to walk. And we also have hands, and not just hands, but we have thumbs. There are some apes that have hands and thumbs, but none of them if you've ever watched a chimpanzee, they can do tremendously interesting things with their hands, but their thumb is much shorter than ours. And they can grasp things, but man is the tool-making animal on this planet. I'll say that with qualification when I say that. If you're just looking at the creature, human being, without the eternal soul, the design of the human being, we have a hand that makes us. Look what you can do. You can bring your index finger and your thumb together. In fact, you can bring all your fingers together. We can make tools. Our hands are not just tools. They can make tools. That's profoundly interesting and unique in the world. Also, and the next four things are like this. We have finger webbing. We have a fat layer under our skin. Some of us have more of that than others, by the way. And we also have an underwater nasal clothing device. And, you know, these observations, those four there, actually spurred a study. Have you ever heard of the concept called the aquatic ape? The aquatic ape, mankind is thought to, in his evolutionary process, at some time spend time in the ocean. And we developed, in the evolutionists, we developed this span of skin between our fingers that helps us to swim with. Well, there's no doubt about this. It does help us to swim to have a little bit of webbing there. And so it does help us to swim very well. Interesting also that the subcutaneous layer of fat that's right under our skin is different than most. You know, the only other mammals that share subcutaneous fat right under the skin is whales and porpoises, seals. Only water-going animals like that, but we also have that. So God designed us to be able to swim in water, apparently. Have you seen the films of water babies where they put the little newborn babies just a few days old, drop them in the water, and they swim, just automatically start swimming, and they don't drown. Mamas pick them up right quick, of course. But in fact, some babies are actually born in a tub of water, and when the baby comes out, his nose closes automatically. You jump in the water or fall in water by accident, you don't immediately swallow water and breathe in water. Your nose has a valve in it, your nostrils do, that automatically closes. Now, if you stay under too long, you might take a gasp and drown, but the automatic quality to that helps us to swim underwater. So it's something that we have. Apes, you throw an ape in the water, I mean, there are some monkeys and apes that can swim, but they have to be taught how to swim. We actually have a natural ability to do that. And the relative hairiness, I said hairless, somebody pointed out in this whole water ape concept was that they put a human in a wind tunnel and blew the wind over the hair, over the body, and the hair goes completely in one direction. It goes the length of your body. So if you swim, the hair lays down on your body to propel you forward. It has a quality of propelling us forward. And that's an interesting design that we didn't necessarily have to have. Apes do not have that. Do not have that quality. So when scientists say that we're kin to apes, they're wrong. We're uniquely designed. We haven't come from apes. We're unique in very specific ways. We're unique. Also, I have a little dog, and sometimes she has tears, and you'll go, oh. But she's not crying because she's sad. She's just got sinus trouble. We cry when we cry. We can cry tears of joy. We can cry tears because we're grieving, whatever it might be. But it's tied to our emotions, and it makes us unique. We also, of course, have the incredible unique ability to speech and to speak and to very deeply, because of abstract thinking in our mind, we're able to conceptualize things and actually convert those into words to communicate with others in tremendously complex ways. And we can make all kinds of tones. And like in our singing, there's not really any animal that could, they either are made for it, but they don't have the complexity of singing, of course, or talking that human beings have. So this is unique in us, too. Also, I guess that's the last one on there, but the one that I've remembered that or found out recently is that we're the only animal that has the ability by emotion to blush. And someone was talking about it in a word study, the word Adam, that it actually comes from Edom, which means red in the face, that we were actually created to be able to blush. And one of the indicators of a proud individual who is immodest in their thinking is that they have forgotten how or lost the ability to blush. So it's completely connected to our thinking and our system of what is right and wrong. And that's a very unique thing in and of itself. Now, I'm going to just get this slide to progress here. There we go. I want us to answer some big questions, and there are some specific things that I want us to think about in this whole thing, having introduced us to the human condition and the physical peculiarities that make us human. And that is, to answer this question, is God real? And let's look at some evidence tonight that will prove that God is real. And did he create, and I put on this, did he create perfectly? And we're going to have to show that he did. And could science mainly be wrong about figuring of time? it seems a very basic thing. We were talking about it the other night, or yesterday, with some that were saying, yes, this is a major flaw in evolution, is the actual figuring of time. Because, you know, all of us are familiar with the idea that most evolutionists believe, and science in general pushes the concept that existence, the Big Bang happened, what, 15 to 17 billion years ago? The idea of all matter that ever was compressed into a sphere the size of a basketball, and then it exploded. And that explosion is what we see in the universe, as we see the constellations, the galaxies and the solar systems within them, and all of that expanding, is all of they're rushing away in that explosion. That's what science says. And I think actually the idea of the Big Bang is harder to believe than the concept of creation. It takes much more wild imagination to believe such a thing. But that's the thing that is taught to us as fact, that we shouldn't even question, because great minds have figured this out. But we actually can think for ourselves, and we need to. Now, I thought it was a good idea to tell you what we're going to see tonight in the things I want to bring up. We're going to talk about irreducible complexity. We're going to talk about Bible kind, as we mentioned in chapter 1 of Genesis. Are there dinosaurs in the Bible? In this category, common sense error science makes, and those are dinosaur tracks of human footprints, incomprehensibly fossilized items, things that shouldn't be fossilized, inconvenient American Indian artifacts, or quite a few actually of those kind of things. Now, if you haven't studied this, this is a quick thing about irreducible complexity. Irreducible means something that cannot be reduced. It cannot be made smaller. If you were building something, think about something that is the most simple device that you can think of. And the device has maybe, let's say, three parts. If you take any of the three parts away, it won't work anymore. And it's based on just a very simple complex of three things, perhaps, or a few things, any one of which, if you took it away, it would just completely not function at all. Well, the interesting thing about complexity of anything that has been designed is there's a level at which it cannot be reduced any further. It actually may be the things in nature that we think of that come to mind that are irreducibly, they're already complete and they cannot be reduced any further, are interesting things. And let me give you the definition here. That there was a book that was written by Michael Behe called Darwin's Black Box. It's a famous book now because evolutionists are on board now to completely destroy the idea of intelligent design, that there was a mind behind creation. And so Michael Behe is the man who introduced the idea of irreducible complexity a few years ago. And so the notion of irreducible complexity, there the colon, by irreducibly complex, I mean a single system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. That's from his page 39. Well, interesting to note that in Darwin's Origin of Species, Charles Darwin said this: if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. He himself, the father of the concept of evolution, introduced the idea of the doubt that if there was some organism that could be found that could not be, that would not function in such a way, that his theory of evolution, remember to always call it theory of evolution because it's not fact, even though some scientists refer to it as the law of evolution, it is still a theory. So in that's irreducible complexity. The complex biological motor that rotates a sperm's tail, the flagellum, isn't the tail part of the structure that we call a sperm cell, is an irreducibly complex biological structure and cannot be built by numerous successive slight modifications. And we can think of some other things. The eye, for one thing, has been thought of in all kinds of creatures, is something that is actually reduced to its least common denominator. You cannot take any one single part away from the eye of a starfish or a squid or a human without destroying the ability to see. That's how perfect the idea of making an organ that can see and translate the information to the brain of whatever the creature is so that it can maneuver and it can live its life, because the eye is perfect in its design. It's an interesting thing to realize. Well, in this little animation, it actually shows, that looks like a machine down there, doesn't it? And the motor that actually turns the flagellum, the little propeller, if you want to think of it, that goes on every animal's sperm cell. It has every animal, not plant, but animals. So this is a, you know, I always thought the films of those kind of things that I saw, that the tail of the sperm was something that was limp, that did like this, as a, like a snake or something. But actually, it's not. It is a mostly a stiff, curly thing, kind of like a propeller of some kind. And the little organ that makes it turn is like a rotor in a machine, and like an engine, like an electric motor. And so it actually has this quality of being able to rotate to propel it forward. I thought it was like a fish or, you know, an eel or something, but it's not. An up close, and I mean incredibly powerful microscopes in a cross section, show the actual physical structure of that machine-like organ that causes the thing independently to rotate. And I mean, every simple animal that has a sperm cell has that little motor in there to propel the thing forward, to do what it's supposed to do. Its purpose is to propel the genetic package within it to mix with the ovum. I don't know the basic story, but it has to, the first one there is the one who shares its information with the egg, and to make the zygote, or the beginning of an embryo, the beginning of a new creature. And that's God's design. These things cannot be broken down to any of their component parts and still work. It will not function. And that, from that regard, that's why it could not have evolved. It had to have been built and made and designed exactly the way it is in order for it to work. Now, so, the majority of living things are dependent upon fertilization by sperm cells. Yet sperm cells, by their design, cannot have evolved. Our conclusion, intelligent design plus the fact that general evolution played no part, proves the existence of God. Now, I know that's, wait a minute, we got to that pretty quick. But you see, it's not really a long journey to determine truth if you want it to be simple. What we need to do is overcome the doubts that the scientific world wants to put in our way, for whatever reasons they do. For whatever reasons they are. You can suspect all kinds of things, but for whatever reasons they do, it does not bear up under the logic of actual observation. Remember, the Apostle Paul refers to science as so-called. Well, it's possible, you see, for us to think of the term science in its purest sense, like the Greeks originally had, is the observance of fact, observable fact. They refer to it as empirical evidence. Things that can be observed and seen and witnessed, and we say, aha, there we go. The reason that evolution cannot be proven is a theory, and never will be anything but a theory, is that billions of years of observation cannot be done. It's just a practical thing. You cannot, none of us are going to live long enough to see something actually evolve in general evolution. Now, there's a difference between general and specific evolution, for just terms of definition. Specific evolution is like adaptation. General evolution is the idea that is real popular. You see it in science fiction movies. Sometimes you see it in documentaries on the Science Channel or something. And it will show the imagined idea of life starting in some kind of chemical filled pool in the pre-dawn of the world, and lightning strikes, you know, and everything happens, and suddenly there's a one-celled animal, you know, and then from that it turns into a multi-celled animal, and then it divides the critter, and then it turns into plant and animal, two different things, and then the thing crawls up on the land, and then it talks to the races and flying and dinosaurs, all that. That's what we're used to seeing. You say, oh yeah, evolution. And that's called general evolution. It's the idea of the spontaneous beginning of life, which was actually proven as wrong in the 1400s. That spontaneous combustion cannot happen. The science today continues to say, well, that was spontaneous combustion. They're actually referring to spontaneous combustion when they try to convince us that general evolution is true. It's already been proven to not be true, but that's the case. We already have proven this quickly that God is. This was a cover of Smithsonian one time. And they dared to ask this question, which, of course, in the rest of the magazine, they said, no, it wasn't wrong. You know, it wasn't wrong. Because they worshipped Darwin. Darwin was an interesting character. He actually never stopped believing in God and was afraid that his observations would decrease faith in God. He made that statement several times. He was afraid of that. he was sort of mixed up. Some of the observations that he made, apparently, he was afraid of, and was afraid of the conclusions that he had drawn. General evolution cannot be proven to actually ever happen. No life ever evolved to different types. I'm using the word type there instead of the word kind, but they're synonymous. So they're the same word, same meaning in those two different words. And we read that in Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 through 31, of the idea, and we'll look at that in more detail in a moment. But he was right. He was wrong about general evolution, but he was right about natural selection by survival of the fittest. He was right about that. That was an observable thing that could be proven, and every single one of us knows that it actually works. We know that it's true. We've seen too many obvious examples of it in nature and in the animals that mankind has actually designed, like cattle and pigs and chickens and dogs and cats and all these things that we've bred and changed to have the characteristics that we want. God gave us the ability to channel these things and to plan such breedings and the outcome, the offspring that would come from such breedings. But what he actually helped, Charles Darwin actually helped to Gregor Mendel had actually done some original studies on it a couple of centuries before on the idea of, I think it was sweet peas that he first determined that you could breed them to do different things, make different varieties of peas. But when Darwin just explained what he did, it really began to dawn on everyone that what had been happening is the adaptation of species. Adaptation, adapting them to be what either man wanted, or sometimes you see in thoroughly in nature, nature adapts things as well. So we're probably aware of the story's been told many, many times about how he took the voyage on a British vessel called the HMS Beagle. And what he did was, it's hard to tell from this little map, this is actually a charting of the Galapagos Islands that he made his observations, and they stayed a good long time there. He took lots of biological samples, and when he took all of these samples, he took them back to England. And I believe it was 30 years he worked on the theory of evolution before he published The Origin of Species by Natural Selection. And what he had observed was an interesting thing. And that was that apparently a type of finch, one species of finch, had been maybe blown over from South America or something, at least one pair, and they had somehow come by the wind or migrations or whatever, ended up in the Galapagos Islands. And then from them, because of the variety of ecosystems on every single island, some islands are deserts and they have cactus on them, some of them are jungles and have all kinds of food available. Some of them are salt flats with no food, hardly any food available. And so these, apparently what happened was, and his explanation was, that the finches had within them the ability to change because of the food that was available for them to eat, and predators and weather and all kinds of things, other things affect the breeding of animals. And so he charted these, and all these different kinds of finches actually came from one kind of finch. Notice there's seed eaters, and there's a whole bunch of different kinds there, and there's insect eaters, there's even a flower bud eating finch. All of these are finches. All of them you can tell by the size of their heads and the shape of their beaks what kind of food they ate. It was indicative of the kind of food they had adapted to eat. But you see the ones that couldn't find anything to eat, we don't see them there because they died. Those that could not adapt died. Those who could adapt bred, and they passed their genes on to the next generation, and it became stronger and stronger to the extent that it developed individual breeds or species of finch. All of them still finches. Now, there's a point to this I want us to see. I want you to open your Bibles, and we're going to turn over to Genesis chapter 1. I want you to see this for yourself. You may have thought of this before. It's sort of like a thunderbolt hit me in the very notion that this is the case. But notice in verses 12 and 13, a peculiar thing that says here, everything was made after its kind. We see that repeated many, many times. In verse 11, and God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, comma, whose seed is in itself. And in the next verse, it says after his kind, whose seed was in itself. Interesting, isn't it? Seed in itself. That's a very interesting thing. In Leviticus and also in Deuteronomy, further, it talks about pelicans and hawks and, you know, sparrows, different kinds of birds and animals are mentioned there. And these are each and every one referred to as kinds in that text. They're kinds. That's interesting. And what I'm thinking here is that when it says whose seed was in itself, remember the sperm cell holding its the male's portion of DNA. It is to meet the female portion of DNA, and the two blend. It is a true thing. When we greet a child into the world, we say, oh, isn't he a beautiful thing? And he is. He's a brand new creature just come into this world. But the truth is, he is a recombination of everything that went before him in both of his parents. He's a new human being. He has his own soul. But as far as the genetic package is concerned, it's a mixture of everything before. And as we watch that child grow up, we'll say, you know, he has eyes like Aunt Susie, you know. He has feet like Uncle George. You know, he has traits that are not just his, but are recombinations of what has come before. And it's because the seed was held the components within itself. And he is a kind, a human kind, is what he is. I made this chart some time back. I even had it on overhead projector slides a long time ago. But what I wanted to show here is this. I read in archaeological books a long time ago that anthropologists and archaeologists had dug all over the world to determine what were the first domesticated animals. And you can go to, let's say, the Ukraine and find horse bones that were apparently used by human beings for various purposes, either eaten or ridden or to pull carts and things, that are many thousands of years old. There are cows in the Middle East, the bones of cows, and they come in different forms. There are different breeds of them, but they're all cows. There's also hogs. There's also even chickens from Southeast Asia that made their way around the world in very interesting ways. And the thing is even, we were talking about Eric Connor, chickens, chickens that lay green eggs tonight, supper. I have some of those too. And the green egg is interesting, but you know, it tastes just like a brown egg, doesn't it? It's just an egg. And those chickens cluck just like a New England Red or a Barred Rock or something. They're chickens. And they've made the journey all the way around to be introduced perhaps by Polynesians into the tip of South America and were not brought by Europeans to Americas at all, but were made their way across the Pacific or something. We don't know exactly. But they're chickens. And you can trace their DNA to the first chickens in Southeast Asia. And the thing is, they didn't become something else. Well, in this whole study of looking at the first of the domesticated animals, the anthropologists and archaeologists referred to these as species, like the Ur of the Chaldees. The very beginning of civilization was always centered in Ur of Chaldees, where, if you remember, where Abraham is from. And so the original domesticated animals are referred to as species. The cow, the goat, the sheep, you know, those kind of, they had actual places in those studies. And so what I did is I took that concept and I said, well, what about the kinds in Genesis? Couldn't we call the kinds that are mentioned in Genesis like species? And I would think that those animals that were even taken onto the ark, onto Noah's ark, were these original species of animals. The interesting thing to think about that is this. Think about all the goats, all the cows, all the sheep, all the swine, all the spiders. A spider always has eight legs. There are thousands upon thousands of breeds of spiders. They always have eight legs. Insects always have six legs. Always. Now, there are other kinds of creatures that have 10 legs and 12 legs and 100 legs and all that, but spiders and insects are always known that it's actually defined that way. The word insect is the same word that we get the word section from. It means pieces or parts. And you look at an insect and he's made up of a head and a thorax and an abdomen. He's parsed. He's an insect. He's made in sections. And all these animals are always the same. They may have, and they do, they have great variety in their form and their color, their size, the environment that they're able to live in, and all those kind of things are unique to each species, but they're still the same kind. The genetic package that is within each kind is diverse enough to produce by adaptation all different kinds of species. So you could, I can think of some things like elephants. In the fossil record are vast numbers of species of elephants that have lived throughout the ages since God created them. And most of them are extinct except the ones in this last lineup here. And they're still all elephants. There's even an elephant that's about the size of a sheepdog, but it has the same skeletal features as the African elephant or the Asian elephant. And they're just elephants. They're thought to be, several hundred thousand years old or several million years old. But the fact is they're still elephants. They're just different forms. The genetic package that God made for elephants was contained within the seed. The identity of the kind was within the seed itself, which they carry within their bodies and are able to pass it on generation to generation. Kinds. So horses are like that. I think of Eohippus, the dawn horse, is kin to the big old Clydesdale. The same thing. From an anatomical study, you'd find that they have nearly all the same bones. The toes of some of them are fused. Some of them, they had actual toes in some of the extinct versions of horses, but they're still horses. Probably all whinny. Probably all bit you, too, if you didn't hope to handle them right. And we have things like the onager today, that's sort of a blend of what we think of a donkey and a zebra and I don't know what all, but just the variety that is possible from within the genetic package that makes up the creature we call horse or equus. Now, you'll see some charts sometimes by scientists. They are striving always to find what is called a transitional form. The vernacular is the missing link. And what they want to do is they want to link, in order to prove general evolution, you have to find examples in the fossil record of something like an amphibian, like a frog, turning into a lizard. Now, most of us think, well, that's pretty close right there. But an amphibian in its general type or genera is just an amphibian. They're always going to be an amphibian. And a reptile is always a reptile. They have unique features that go within each of those great families of animals. But they never become each other. Even though in general evolution studies, they always show them as morphing into the thing because they really wanted to. They really wanted to, but they can't actually find real fossils of intermediate stages. They only find the kinds. It's always so confusing and so hard for them to admit that it's just a kind of whatever the creature is. It's not, if it hadn't become something else. Now, there are entire kinds of animals that are completely extinct. They found things that are not related to anything else. They completely died out because of whatever natural environment of some kind. They just disappeared. They're totally extinct. I've heard some people, whether it's true or not, but you hear this, that literally only 1% of all animals ever living are still alive. That 99% of all animals that at one time existed are extinct now. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a fantastic figure if you think about it. In this chart, that thing on the top is hilarious to me. But they have found the bones of this thing, some kind of ocean-going creature, like a whale or something. And notice it had they have had to kind of draw in the arms and the legs on the thing. And the next animal that was more primitive than that, what they're trying to show is that ultimately became a land-dwelling animal whose legs got bigger and bigger, but that at the bottom it started out as some kind of fish, okay? And we've seen fish almost similar to that. And then over millions and millions of years, they call it the transition period, it comes to the next creature whose fins become more articulated with fingers within the fins. And then ultimately, you see the thing there called the tic-tac lick. It's an Eskimo word, of course. That, pretend it's not there and go to the next one. They're jumping from the actual fossil record of this thing here, the second one, to get to that second one from the top because they don't actually have the bones of that transitional form. They don't have that one. But they have postulated, it's a weird creature that they've come up with, but they say they're still looking for them. There had to be a creature that made the transition between a fin-bearing fish into a reptile that eventually evolved to the point that it crawled on the land. They don't have this animal. They don't have it. But they make charts to show us that as if the animal actually exists, but there's no such fossil in the record. Now, and I wanted you to think about that, but The thing that's very interesting is that the Bible does talk about dinosaurs. You know, when I was a little kid, I was a typical boy in the fact that how many of your boys love dinosaurs? I mean, the movies of Jurassic Park and all that stuff, it's great. Something that can run you down and eat you, you know, eat lawyers off the pot, you know, right off in the movie. You love that stuff. I kind of like that part. But actually in Job chapter 40, verses 15 through 18, it's a curious passage. Well, a lot of us have looked at that and said, what in the world is that thing? Look now at the behemoth, which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now, his strength is in his hips, and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar, and I underline that. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze. His ribs like bars of iron. In the Hebrew commentaries about what behemoth was, they say that behemoth was a little hippo, a little fat hippo. Have you ever seen the tail of a hippo? It's pretty disgusting. And you don't want to know what it does, but it's pretty nasty. And we laugh at them because they're funny, but they kill more people in Africa than crocodiles or lions or anything else because they have a bad temper. But in the Hebrew commentaries, they refer to behemoth as it must have been a hippopotamus. But we know that when we look at that little tail that's kind of like a pigtail on there, that it's not a cedar of Lebanon. We know that. It's not a cedar of Lebanon. So the creature is different. There was a book. I'm gonna show. When I was a kid, we thought dinosaurs dragged their tails around and all that. We don't show them that way anymore because the study of anatomy has shown that the tail was actually kind of stiff. And there was a book that I read probably 35 years ago when this new thing came out, was the idea that dinosaurs were different than typical reptiles in that they had hearts that pumped hot blood. They were like mammals and birds in the sense that they had a higher metabolism than reptiles did, and I suppose that's true. Anatomists usually are very literal kind of people, and I suppose that's probably right. But in the study of anatomy, in the tails of these dinosaurs, all of them that they find, they weren't like a snake or something. They're actually stiff. They kind of went from side to side, but they didn't drag them, you know, like a big dead piece of meat or something around, like the old claymation things that we saw in old movies. They don't show them that way anymore because science has actually been good about showing the anatomical nature. You know, for instance, a snake. If you ever pick up a snake, I've had the occasion lately to do that. They don't just do like this. They actually go from their spine, makes them bend to the side, not down like this. They can do it, but their actual you can hurt them by doing it, by forcing them to bend like that, belly down. But they go from side to side. All reptiles do that. Their vertebrae are built to go for side to side movement. And apparently, in the actual structure of the dinosaur at the top there, they must have moved around on two legs with their tail as a counterbalance, and they held that tail out in order to bend over and eat, and then they could stand back up. Those little water things, you know, the little bird thing the cup of water, it's sort of like that. They used that to counterbalance the weight of their body to rise back up. Well, the faster heartbeat combined with the body weight cantilevered over the rear legs, and with the tail rigid, helped them to move fast. It probably did. You can't see that thing on there. But behemoth's tail was, as it's described in the scriptures, was like a cedar of Lebanon. It was like a dinosaur that we see that's popularly illustrated. I think they probably got that part, the anatomical part, probably close to right. It fits with behemoth. So did behemoth get loaded on the ark when the flood was coming? Maybe. And then they just simply died out since then. Maybe they were a triceratops or something like that. We don't know. But there may have been some dinosaurs that actually survived for a while, and like all the 99% of all life that's ever lived, they simply died out at one time or another. Well, another obvious thing for Christians, for believers, is that we have a real understanding, a real suspicion. In fact, we're certain, because if God lives and is, and is true, and his word is all real, and we believe that it is, then they have to have time figured wrong. Somehow they've done it wrong. We just know they have. And the reason for that, and I usually tell people when they ask me how old do I think existence is, how the earth is. I say this, even though the Bible is not intended to be a timekeeping device or document of record, if we counted up the apparent lapse of time in the Bible's vast history, we would come up with no more than even possibly 10 to 20,000 years. And that's very generous, because strictly speaking, it's literally about 6,000 years. And you have to kind of have an imagination to make it any longer than that. So I'm saying it's not intended to be a timekeeper, but you can actually only account for 6,000 years strictly kept. We can guess that there was more time, but we're not certain of it. Evolutionists believe the Earth is billions of years old and use various means to date every fossil found to usually be many millions of years old, and their methods do not fit with observable science. I'm going to show you some examples of what I mean. We're all used to looking at a charts like this that show really primitive animals at the deepest levels. So you're going to have trilobites and, you know, ammonites and things like that at the very bottom, crustaceans and things at the bottom. And then they become, because it fits with evolution, that as things evolve in earlier, in later times and then newer times, it's going to reflect their complexity the newer they happen to be, the newer strata in the earth. We were when we went up on Mount Rainier Saturday, and the weather was so pretty, there was a place where we went through the mountains and they could cut straight into the mountain for the road to be there, and you could see the clear strata in that cliff face, different colors, different textures of minerals that were involved in that. Now, the evolutionists and the geologists sung to Aaron, or that was Jordan, I think it was, last night, and there are lots of people who have studied geology, and they come to this situation where they're teaching that the stratification of the earth can be illustrated in when we see it in such cases like that cliff face I'm talking about, that it actually ages, and the lower the level is on it, the older it is. And the top of it is, of course, the newer part. As each successive centuries and thousands and millions of years go by, that gets deeper and deeper and deeper, or higher and higher and higher, and only the things on the top are the newer, right? Then we're all familiar with that, and that's what this chart shows. We'll have such things, and it's not showing all of them, but there'll be such a thing as the Pennsylvania strata, which is more toward the top, Mississippian, Devonian, Cambrian, which is one of the very oldest. There is a classic picture. I got the website that's on here from where I got listed these pictures. But this is a tree trunk. And if you'll notice right here in the bottom part is coal. The roots of that tree is in a strata of coal that is said to be 380 million years old. The top of the tree is in the Cretaceous, which is only 60 million years old. And how in the world did one tree live that long? We know that that's not possible. There are some things about fossilization that we don't apparently understand, though science tells us that they do, because it has to fit within the theory of evolution. There's a little river close to where I live. There's a little town called Glen Rose, about 50 miles northwest of Waco. And the Paluxy River is a small river, and it rolls over solid rock of what's called Lower Cretaceous, and it actually goes through lower than that. I've taken a lot of kids in the church out looking for fossils, and all we find is the kind of critters that lived in the ocean or at that time, during that time. But here in the Paluxy River, they find classical dinosaur tracks. I've actually seen them, put my foot in them and everything else a few years ago. And they have also found in this not just dinosaur tracks, but human tracks that have to be 140 million years old. Well, according to science, we only evolved, you see, in the last 2 or 3 million years. And those that were before that were just apes, you see. And so they found this, you know, originally they said that was a carving. This is found in somewhere in Texas. I suppose if this is true, then it would be anywhere, right? You could find it just anywhere. And they found this footprint, and so immediately people said, well, that's, somebody carved that just to make money, you know. Well, they put it in, I actually saw this thing, it's down at the Creation Science Museum in Glen Rose. They took that stone, and you see the cuts, they did use a diamond saw, and they cut right across the toes, and actually down here too. And if you can see, there is where apparently the foot pressed down, there's compression fossil within the sand that was stepped on. And so it actually shows the compression of the sand as the weight of the foot came down into it. And that sort of proves that something weighed into it to press down and make that footprint, a big human foot, instead of somebody carving it out of stone, which wouldn't show the compressions that are actually shown up in the diamond slabs that are cut. They also found, a number of years ago, long after the first one was found, they found something called, they call it the lady finger fossil. And because they put a woman's finger alongside it, so it doesn't look feminine, whatever. But anyway, this is the, I saw that thing too. Well, they cut across it with one of these diamond saws to get an even cut. And it actually shows the ossification of the finger bone in the center of it. They cut through, if you've ever noticed in bone, there's little air pockets, and that actually shows the air pockets inside the bone. It actually shows the adipose tissue around it. This was a real tissue and bone artifact that fossilized. When did that happen? The human beings are supposed to only have been, and never any human beings in North America until they say 14,000 years ago. But this is 160 or 140 million years old. Well, that's an interesting thing. In the dinosaur footprints, there's one dinosaur footprint, so there's two. It actually has a human footprint in the middle of it. And that's what the colored outline is trying to show, is that when you see this, the actual thing, you can see the footprint as if a human was following after the dinosaur and stepped in its footprint. How audacious a thing is that? But yet the thing exists, and it's a real footprint. They found in the Dakota strata, North Dakota, I believe it is, they found these bones, malachite man from the Dakota sandstone, depth of 58 feet, 140 million years old, in North America, where American Indians are not said to have come till 14,000 years ago. And so there are 10 skeletons, 6 male, 4 female. They're green. They turned into malachite, which is copper ore. Why have not the Native Americans claimed the remains as relatives for burial? Because it doesn't fit within any of the time frames that have been structured for actual remains of Indians so that they can repatriate them and bury them, give them a tribal burial, because they don't fit within the pattern. They are 140 million years old, according to science. There's not human beings that far back, right? According to evolution, there's not. And yet these things exist. Ira Ann is a little town in West Texas. It's named after a man and woman named Ira and Ann. I know. But they found this boot in a ditch made in 1936 in San Angelo. I lived in San Angelo one time. It's got a rubber sole. Leather has been cut away from it to reveal the completely fossilized foot of some cowboy with the ankle bones still in it. The flesh, it also has been fossilized. And this is an artifact that is known, and scientists absolutely do not know what to do with it. The flesh and bone fossilized, and the leather and the rubber is just from 1936. It's weird, isn't it? You see, the thing that we're pointing out here is that we do not understand completely what makes things fossilize. Scientists say they do know, but we find artifacts that defy explanation. And when it does, it destroys the science. The science is not right. It's wrong. It misfigured something. It's got something wrong about that. I'll show you a bunch of real strange stuff right quick. Stranger than that. In South America, they have found, you can't really see this very well, but there are tapestries that Indians made that show weavings of, like, brontosauruses, or, you know, different dinosaurs in the blankets. You know, that's weird. They also have pots that show men fighting dinosaurs, you know, or dragon-like things. There's a triceratops up there. Here's a man standing, something like a T-Rex or something. What? You know, they're very old. They're 700 or 800 years old. This is a member of the church that's a geologist. His name is Don Patton. Some of you may have heard of him. He has done a lot of studies on evolution. And you see there's some petroglyphs that are protected by the American government that show Triceratops was wiped out 65 million years ago, they think, by, you know, a meteor hitting the earth and destroying all the dinosaurs, and yet the American Indians carved it. That's very strange. There are little petroglyphs like this that are bipedal dinosaurs that are found as well. There was a German named Waldemar Julsrud who excavated 37,000 figurines thought to be 2,500 years old down in Mexico, Guanajuato, and they're dinosaurs that they, you know, made that were found, 37,000 of them. You know, if you were going to do a hoax of something, you'd make two or three or something, you wouldn't make 37,000. And they are remarkably show features of the anatomical structure of animals that apparently are extinct, that they studied, that the scientists have studied. And so you have things like the ankylosaurus, and there's a thing down here that looks like an ankylosaurus, a little clay figurine that's made like that. Also, you know, Indians fancifully fighting dinosaurs and that kind of thing. And a lot of them, there's a lot of those kind of little emblems, a little images that we can think of. And so, you know, there are actual dinosaurs that the anatomists have come up with, that they structure the animal like this, and yet the Indians, 2,500 years ago, made the little clay figurines that look remarkably like them. That, you know, not that they were scientists or anything. But I think that in our looking at all of this, we have to say, well, Mark, that's kind of just made a lot of confusion about some things, but really, the truth is that science is mistaken for whatever reasons that we can imagine or that we can, whatever it is, it's wrong about some key things that we are sort of being forced by the government, by education, by the powers that be in our society that want to force God out of the equation in every way that they possibly can. They want science, apparently, to rule out the existence of God somehow. And we're supposed to go along with it because they think we're ignorant. When actually, just by, you don't have to be a great scientist. All you have to do is one who observes. What we can observe is there are things here that defy explanation. Therefore, the explanation given by science is wrong. Somehow, it's wrong. And, what I would say here is that God created perfectly. One of the things I wanted to show at the very beginning is, did God create and did he create perfectly? And so irreducible complexity by itself really can prove that God exists. Also, science is wrong about the reckoning of time. I think we've proven both of those points. And therefore, God is real. So if God is real, what do you suppose our attitude should be about revering his word, like in Hebrews 11, verse 6? But without faith, it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. That doubt that we had originally as a youngster, that turned into faith based upon evidence that we have ourselves proven for ourselves, builds faith. God will reward those who diligently seek him. Believe in God because he's real. The charts real often show us that we came from a steady progression, and it was a shaky thing that we even came into existence, you know. I was heard the other night on the documentary that there was a bottleneck in time, and there was actually only 200 specimens of humanity at one time, and that all of mankind comes from just 200 individuals, or some cataclysm on the face of the earth, and we all come, our genetic mix, the things that make us who we are, only came from 200 individuals millions of years ago. I don't know how they come up with that, but the idea is that we came from some bipedal ape. There may have been apes that walked on two legs and they're simply extinct. There may have been species, races of man that looked different somehow than we are, but they were still human beings. They still made fire and they still made tools. They're just not in evidence anymore. I've seen some people that kind of fit those, though, but, you know, we don't want to talk about that. But, you know, so we're familiar with this progression. We're familiar with it. Everybody's familiar with it. Not anybody's new to this. But, the Bible has knowledge within it that fills in all of our doubts. Look at the 8th Psalm, verses 3 and 4. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? You know, God has provided, if we use our minds, if we just observe, if we just make sense of things, we will, on our own, from God's creation and our power of deduction, prove to ourselves that our faith must be real, that it should be real. Adam and Eve, the first human beings, and I think it's good for you to note here, in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 13. Let's start over there and look at that right quick. We're going to close in just a minute. 1 Timothy 2 and verse 13. For Adam was first formed, then Eve. This is in the New Testament. We're not going to the Old Testament for this information right here. It has been affirmed by the Holy Spirit in the New Testament, the law in which we are to obey. That Adam, this, you see, the knowledge that's given to us in Genesis is corroborated here in the New Testament of Jesus Christ. That Adam, you see, was first formed, then Eve. Now, he's making another point here, but we want to draw this fact here and think about this. Also, all humans came from a solitary human couple. Genesis chapter 3 and verse 20 has told us that. We know that that's the case. And that God actually in chapter 2 ordained marriage. The man and woman should cleave to each other. The man should leave his parents and cleave unto his wife, and they become one flesh. No longer are there two separate things, but one. There's a reason for that, that as we bond with our spouse, we become one flesh. We actually, the seed is within us, and we pass it on to the next generation. The next generation, the child that's born, is a human being, just like we were human beings. We are in that kind that God, the ultimate creature in all of creation, is mankind. We are made in His image. No other animal is made in His image. We are made in His image, and on top of that, in this concept of the duality of man, we have an eternal component that God breathed into us, and every single one of us, the soul is going to return to God when this whole creature that is so unique lays down in its last breath and gives up its soul. It goes back to God who gave the soul in the beginning. It's an eternal quality that no other animal has. We have that. God loves us that much. And Acts chapter 17, verse 26, it says, out of one, in a sense, the stock of one male, like he breathed things, you'd say, well, what's his lineage? Well, there you go. Adam was the first man, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 45. Eve is the mother of all living, Genesis chapter 3, and verse 20. We know, therefore, that the stock of mankind comes from two people. Within the genetic package, the DNA of Adam and Eve, all of the races of man are possible. All of the short people, the bald people, the dark people, the light people, all of the people that have ever been were in the genetic package of Adam and Eve that God created. In His infinite wisdom, He gave us the ability to adapt to different climates and to different temperatures and to different food sources. And so we have become different races of man, but every race of man can interbreed with any other race of man because we're still of the same kind. The genetic package that God made is within the seed that holds its own genetic code. God invented DNA. It's just that simple. So when we, in the final analysis in all of this, and we look at the image of this great old dancer here doing his thing, the Word of God was tailor-made for mankind. One of my favorite passages, I think. I could say that about a bunch of them, I guess. But Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 12. Think about this, for the Word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit and of joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. You see, the Lord designed us. Of course He understands how we're made. He understands our shortcomings. He understands our strengths, our capabilities. He knows that we can conceptualize. He gave us the ability to conceptualize like He did. We, in a sense, can be creative in the mind, in the abstract form of our mind that He put within us, inherent in every single one of us. So we write music. We do art. We write books and poetry. And we imagine things. We design buildings and machines and clothing and medicine and all kinds of things. God gave us the ability to do that. But He understands us completely, and He gave us the Word in order to govern our wills and in order to show us the way ultimately to have the thing He wants us to most to have, and that's eternal life. So we turn to the Word of God. Once we completely believe that God is, if God exists, we need to listen to His Word and do His will. That's the purpose of studying a little lesson on evolution, is to instill within us the recognition of the fact that God is and that we need to be diligent seekers of Him. Tonight, I hope these things have been of interest to you and that you can take something from it, maybe teach your kids or maybe even help you, you know, as adults and anybody else that you see. There's things, especially, I think the idea of the kinds is one that resonated with me when it finally came to me that that was something that had been staring me in the face for a very long time. The Lord provides the information that can build the faith within us. And I ask you tonight to carefully consider the Scriptures and to recognize the great mind and the great glory and the great power of our God in heaven. As together we stand and sing.
Right.